Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare. It is Monday, November 13th, and we've moved the agenda around a little bit. Oregon Health Policy Board is not here. And welcome, Senator Knobe and Senator Steiner Hayward. Glad to have you here, and I think Byer should be on his way. All right, with that, any comments from Senator Knope or Senator Steiner Hayward? No. All right. Let's start with DCBS then, the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Gene Strait, TK King, and Cheeky Flowers.
Cheeky isn't here yet.
No one's here. I think they're still.
We're here.
I know. We are here. I think they're still getting used to daylight savings time. Who knows?
Well, good morning, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jean Strait, and I'm the Acting Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services. And here with me today is TK Keene, our Deputy Administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation, and Cheeky Flowers will be here, hopefully, before we're done and before she needs to talk. And she is our Administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. So I will give you just a brief update on some of the leadership transition stuff that we have going on at the agency, and then TK will give you an update on the cost-sharing subsidies and the marketplace rates for 2018 health plan. And then when Cheeky gets here, we'll have her give you an update on the Oregon's 1332 waiver application. So as most of you know, on September 1st, DCBS had quite a few leadership changes. Our director, Patrick Allen, moved over to the Oregon Health Authority, and so did our insurance commissioner and administrative for the Division of Financial Regulation, Laura Kelly. And so we started recruitments on both those positions. We're in the process of that right now. Final interviews for the DFR administrator will be on the 30th of November. And then the director's position recruitment, the governor's office is actually managing that recruitment, but second round interviews are this week. And we are on schedule to have employment offers out to both those candidates, whoever they may be, mid-December, no later than mid-December. So we should have somebody on board no later than the first of the year. So,
questions?
Okay, well, that's my update, and we haven't had any more leadership transitions since September, and we're thankful for that at DCBS, so I'm going to turn it over to TK.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is TK Keene. I'm Deputy Administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation, and I want to talk a little bit today about our 2018 rate review process, as well as the loss of the cost-sharing reduction payments that occurred back in October. So just to start off with a little bit of background, the Oregon individual health insurance market is made up of 210,000 individuals that split 130,000 that are on exchange and 80,000 that are off exchange. For plan year 2018, there were seven companies reviewed, and rate increases ranged from an average of 3.5% to 19.2%. To peg that for you for some approximate pricing, silver plan premiums for a 40-year-old in Portland range from $380 to $484 per month. It's worth noting that with the new Oregon reinsurance program, the figures I just gave you reflect a 6% decrease in those rates. It's been factored in. So turning next just briefly to the small group market, which is another market for which we set rates. There are approximately 170,000 individuals in that market. Nine companies participate, and for plan year 2018, we saw increases from 3.3% to 10.1%. I will next go to the loss of the federal cost-sharing reduction payments and the impact those had on our rates for 2018. So cost-sharing reduction payments, or CSRs, as I'll call them throughout the remainder of this, are plans with lower deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance for consumers. Insurers are compensated for the lower deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance through the CSR payments made by the federal government. CSR plans are available in the individual market to households earning between 100 and 250% of the federal poverty level that choose a silver level marketplace plan. Insurers often insurers are required to offer CSR plans to participate in the marketplace, and there are about 50,000 Oregonians who are currently enrolled in CSR plans. Payments of the CSRs at the federal level have been a matter of dispute for several years, as the House of Representatives and the executive branch have battled over whether there needs to be a specific appropriation from to allow for the executive to make those CSR payments. It had been broadly speculated that President Trump would end CSR payments at some point, and because of the legal controversy in making the payments, and also because the payments were being made on a month-to-month basis at the discretion of the White House, most state regulators did not view it likely that the stream of CSR payments would continue on indefinitely. During our rate review for 2018, we asked carriers to provide us with their analysis of how a loss of CSR payments would impact rates, and we took that information into consideration along with information provided by Wakely Consulting and the Congressional Budget Office to allow our actuaries to conclude that the loss of CSR payments would result in a 7.1% increase for individual market silver plans. Once we received notice in mid-October that the executive branch was no longer going to be making the CSR payments, we immediately got in touch with our carriers and began to work through the various contingency plans that we had laid out several months back in trying to figure out the best way forward. Unfortunately, when we did contact them and the point in time that this occurred, the rates for 2018 had already been loaded onto the federal IT platform, and so there was really at that juncture little hope of having anything changed. The very next day we received word from our federal partners at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that they would open up a brief four-day window for our carriers to reload rates. Because we had done contingency work in advance preparing for this possibility, our carriers had on hand the rates to reload, and we were able to, in fact, facilitate carriers reloading rates for the 7.1% increase to make up for the loss of the CSRs. States considered a number of strategies in deciding where to place the loss of CSR payments with respect to the various metal tiers. Oregon, along with over 30 other states, elected to load the entire loss of the CSR payments on silvers. This strategy allowed for allowed consumers to maximize their advanced premium tax credits, minimize the impact to the silver plans, and kept the pricing for all other metal tiers the same. The one effect it did have was that silver plans that were not subsidized bore the full brunt of the 7.1% increase. Given the unknowns on how CSRs would be distributed across the market, we had a lot of concerns that, you know, should one or two carriers end up with all of the CSR plans without subsidization, there was potential for some instability in the market. And so we requested that carriers reload, and they considered it and decided to do so. DCBS, in consultation with our legal counsel, also determined that there were several mechanisms that we needed to examine before we decided to modify the rates and open up a comment period. And in consultation with the Department of Justice, we looked at ORS 743 and determined that the appropriate method to do this was to extend the original comment period, reopen it for public comment, and treat this as a modification of rates. We opened up the comment period for a limited period of time, and in that time we got 13 public comments. Those comments were posted to our agency website. We have, just to provide the committee with some history, we have in the past used a similar process to extend public comment periods when we've needed to do these adjustments. And so very recently in 2016, we reopened a public comment period during the reconsideration of rates to allow carriers to take on additional geographic territory, for example. In sum, we were prepared for the loss of the CSRs and had our carriers prepared for the possibility of the loss of CSRs, and we believe that this process went as smoothly as possible given the limited time frame that we had to work with. A couple points in terms of the broader legal challenges. There are two lawsuits that are currently working their way through the court system. Oregon is currently part of one in California that was attempting to obtain injunctive relief to maintain the CSR stream of payments. The judge very recently denied that request for injunctive relief, and those two cases will continue to work their way through the court system. So I anticipate we'll be back here sometime in the future with a further update on that aspect of things. As you might imagine, this many changes leading up to open enrollment has a potential, given the number of notices that carriers are required to provide to consumers, to have points of confusion. We have been working closely with our carriers to ensure that consumers are obtaining the most relevant information to their particular situations and minimize the number of irrelevant notices.
When is enrollment end?
December 15th.
15th.
Okay. Yes. One additional question that we've been asked is whether or not any state funds were used to backfill for the loss of CSRs, and the answer to that is no. We used the process I described to have that loaded into the rates, so there were no state funds that were used to backfill for that. So that's the presentation I had planned regarding rates and CSRs, and I'll stop there and see if anybody has any questions.
Have you been tracking any of the enrollment processes now? I mean, is there an indication if the Silver Plan is, are there less people now signing up because of the increase that are not getting subsidies?
Yeah, I believe we have 1 week of statistics, and Chickie Flowers is now stepping up here, but just in time. But the it's been widely reported in the media that, you know, open enrollment numbers for first week are up compared to where they have been in the past, and so I think that's a good sign generally for open enrollment. But I don't think we have at this point in time, and I'll yield to Chickie as to whether we have any split in the number of people picking up silver plans versus other metal tiers.
Good morning, Chair Mon Sanderson and the rest of the committee. My name is Chickie Flowers. For the record, I'm the administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. As TK mentioned, yes, there have been reports that all across the nation, state-based marketplaces have seen record numbers for the opening weekend. We've received unofficial numbers, and we are waiting for CMS to release the official numbers. We are looking at, ideally, hopefully making at least 75% of last year's open enrollment numbers, which is hopefully around 125,000 folks.
Could I ask a clarifying question about that? Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Flores, 75%, my question is, why 75%? Do we think more people are getting employer-based insurance? We know our Medicaid numbers are going down, so they're not transitioning to Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. So those are unofficial numbers, Senator Hayward. We don't know. Unfortunately, that's one of the downsides of not having our own technology. We don't know where our folks are going. But those are just because of how we've looked at trends of where between such a shorter open enrollment period with just 6 weeks. That is just our very conservative estimates.
Follow-up quick question. Could you remind me, because I get lost in the details sometimes, what is the state allowed or not allowed to do to promote open enrollment under our current structure, and what has the legislature agreed is an appropriate role for DCBS to take in promoting open enrollment?
Thank you for your question, Senator Hayward, and members of the chair. So we are allowed to do outreach and marketing. So with that, with a shorter open enrollment period and with a much less budget that CMS has appropriated for advertising, we've upped up our budget for marketing and outreach. And we are doing TV, out-of-home, billboards. We're doing mailers, email. We're doing a whole lot of different tactics to make sure that everybody knows it's open enrollment period. It ends on December 15th. And make sure to sign up at healthcare.gov to find out if they're eligible for financial assistance.
Social media as well?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, because that's the younger people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're doing a whole lot of Facebook. We're doing Twitter. We're doing email.
Right.
Google advertising, name it. We're doing everything.
Thank you very much.
Any other question?
Yes, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just roughly figuring, it looks like the effect of the CSR is somewhere between a $25 and $40 a month increase in cost. Is that what I'm trying to?
Chair Bonus Anderson, Senator Byer, yes, that would be approximately a ballpark. Yes, sir.
So what was the total increase then? What's that work out to? A little less than $100 a month from what they were paying currently?
Yeah, and it's difficult to tell. I mean, that's a good ballpark, but it's difficult because you end up with
different plans.
Different plans and different tax situations. So, yeah.
Great.
1332.
Okay, so next presentation we have is from Chicky Flowers regarding 1332 waiver updates.
Good morning again, Chair Lawrence Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, Chicky Flowers, Administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. And I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself. I don't do this often enough, so I keep doing, hopefully I'm doing the protocol correctly. In terms of the 1332 waiver, as you all know, we have been one of the few states that have our 1332 waiver application. We are within that 45-day period where CMS has asked us to come back with additional numbers to reevaluate our actuarial and economic analysis because of the CSR developments. And those numbers, we're getting that back from our vendor within actually this week, and we are slated to submit that to CMS by 11/15. So once that's once that's complete, they have 45 days to provide us with their official grant award. So that puts that timeline through 12/30 of this year to find out how much CMS is kicking in for our reinsurance program.
Any questions? Great. We'll expect you back in January, our next informational days, because we'll have probably, hopefully, more information.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I saw that the Oregon Health Policy Board's Action Plan for Health person is here, Felisa Higgins. Good morning.
Morning. Okay, this is my first time doing these. Hi, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I sit on the Oregon Health Policy Board. And so I'm here to talk about the Action Plan for Health Refresh. So the original, maybe I am. Here we go. So the Action Plan for Health was originally created at the beginning of the Health Policy Board in 2009. The board spent 12 months sort of traveling around the state, doing listening sessions, conducting interviews with stakeholders. I think many of you actually had the opportunity to attend various listening sessions in your communities, and so they were huge. And it was really fantastic hearing from Oregonians about what they thought the direction of healthcare, where the direction of healthcare should go. In 2010, so it sort of boiled down to a couple of things, sort of these three things, guided by Oregon's triple aim: better health, better care, lower costs. The plan included legislative action and instead helped guide Oregonians in achieving the triple aim vision. It also helped guide the agency's budget priorities, and changing how we delivered healthcare, ensuring health equity, promoting health, and containing costs. So, gosh, I keep pushing the wrong one, sorry. Okay, so after 5 years of health system transformation, the OHPB board recognized that we needed to do a refresh on the action plan for health that moved us beyond the current action plan to implement a new vision, or kind of a refresh. It didn't start over or scrap the old action plan. It built on the foundations that the original action plan had created. So over the last year, the board and OHA worked to update the action plan for health, and so now I'm here to talk about the 2017 through 2019 action plan for health. I really So here's the laid out framework for the action plan for health, which it started with an update to the overall vision that updated the guiding principles and established foundational strategies to move forward. Sort of the vision area should be relevant long term, and I would say the update of the vision was a little bit of wordsmithing, but the overall vision for Oregon about the moving forward on the triple aim, cost, access, quality, remained the same. And then after each of those is the focus areas and the action items. And each of the action items outlines sort of what are the next steps in sort of operationalizing the core focus areas. So you can see here in this, maybe you can see here. in this, we maybe should have divided this up, but it's a. You can see that the Health Policy Board and the Health Authority is incredibly busy implementing the action plan for health. So this slide lays out the high-level majority of work. So you can see the first box here, pay for outcomes. So underneath each of those is sort of a key strategy. So sustainable healthcare spending, value-based payment approaches, multi-payer alignment, evidence-based coverage guidelines, pharmaceutical cost containment. So after each one of those laid out for each of these major action plans, as you look across the top in the orange boxes, shift the focus upstream, improve health equity, increase access to health care, enhance care coordination, engage stakeholders and community partners, and measure progress. Under each of those are the sort of key foundational action items or strategies to accomplish that box ahead. So I don't want to say that this is the complete picture of the work that's being done at the Oregon Health Policy Board, but it's a good sort of overall roadmap of what's happening. And there's always room in those additional gray boxes. As we move forward, we may develop more strategies. And then under each of those gray boxes is the key actions. And so you can see that they're really prioritized based on its alignment with the direction of the Health Policy Board, work that is innovative and moves Oregon forward, any work that's requested by the legislature, the governor, or the OHA director, and deliverables by the OHPB committees. And so you can see this is 4.1, healthcare workforce, monitor and support the traditional healthcare workers certification process. And then after that, you can see the relevant committees here, the Healthcare Workforce Committee, Behavioral Health Collaborative. Those are the little acronyms that are after it. I know that each of you have received the full action plan for health. This spells that out a little bit in more detail. And at each health policy board, we have an agenda that's built through the year where these action plans come back to the board for discussion about how the agency is moving forward, how the committees are moving forward on the work, and what are the key actions that we'd like to request of the governor, the legislature, or the agency.
So when these action plans, we want them to be implemented statewide, do we have outcomes, deadlines, those types of things?
Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, yes. We have outcomes under each of them. That's under the measure for performance, core portion of it, as well as a timeline. This is just a list of the actions, but in the action plan for health and the health policy board sees a timeline of implementation. Some of these things will continuously be ongoing, but some of them do have end dates. So if we were to take a, for example, 4.1D, update policy recommendations regarding need competencies of future workforce, that's probably an ongoing item because, you know, we may do it for traditional healthcare workers first. Then there may be other healthcare categories that we'd want to do it for, specialties, et cetera. But when it comes to monitor and support the healthcare workforce certification process, right, the OHPB board and the workforce board would set up a timeline for that.
So I was noticing under the pharmacy cost containment issue,
okay,
there.
Yes.
I mean, there's going to be legislation starting,
yes,
in the House. transparency primarily, I think, but I haven't heard the latest. But what I'm wanting to know is if we legislators come forward with plans, how can you communicate to us if this is within the scope of what the Health Policy Board is dealing with? I mean, what's the relationship there?
Chairman Ms. Anderson, members of the committee, so I can give, I'll talk about pharmacy, but another example is vaccines. So the Health Policy Board had a report on vaccines last year, and so sent a letter taking action to support the legislation around vaccinations. So this year, what's happening is on pharmacy, we just laid out a timeline and a plan at our last meeting to support the transparency legislation that was introduced last session, if it's going to be reintroduced, which our assumption is the same as your assumption. Introduce legislation that moves all state agencies into OPDP, and then develop a pharmacy work group. Actually, there are several pharmacy work groups that are currently under the Health Policy Board, but develop a broader scope work group to look at the total cost of a pharmacy and see how we can manage those costs. So that's the back and forth relationship. There is another every health policy board meeting during the legislative session, the staff of the Oregon Health Authority brings forward the list of legislation that's out there pertaining to the health authority. We receive regular updates throughout the legislative session. And then always there's community testimony at the health policy board where community members, John Mullins was a regular at our health policy board meetings who would bring things forward both from the Medicaid advisory committee but also from the legislature for us to hear about and support.
Senator Steiner, here.
Thank you. Ms. Higgins, I know we don't have boatloads of time, but if you would be kind enough to say three words about the work on social determinants of health and how you're partnering with other organizations to address those issues, or about how the health policy board is looking at that, and then perhaps send the committee a little bit more information about that work. I mean, I think that work is so important because we really can't have a healthy population if people aren't eating or having safe places to live that they can afford or getting well educated or whatever.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I appreciate the question, and I think the Health Policy Board is recognizing the social determinants of health and moving strategies upstream. So if you were to, I don't know if I can go back on here.
I see it on this slide at the very bottom. That's why I asked the question, actually.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah. Great. So I think a couple of places where the social determinants of health are really coming into play. One is the modernization of public health. What does that look like, and how does public health connect with medical health and looking at the social determinants of health and measuring upstream? The second place definitely is in the CCO 2.0 discussion, which I'm sure the legislature will be heavily involved in moving forward, around measurements and metrics. I think also the work that the Transformational Center is. The Transformational Center is this incredible place in the Health Policy Board that has helped CCOs really transform their model of providing medical care. And I think the Transformation Center is also beginning to have discussions about how do you integrate social determinants of health. And a lot of CCOs actually are doing incredible work around the state, whether that's investments in housing. We were just in Astoria recently. And it was really incredible. The CCO had placed a psychologist in a school there, and they had a group of kids who had behavioral problems, who had been suspended or had disciplinary action 42 times in the previous year, with the placement of a psychologist in the school working with people directly where they're at. That number's dropped to 15, was the report. So I think and 15 disciplines, not suspensions. As we know, kids in school should stay in school. So some of that incredible work is happening in our local communities, and I know the interim is getting shorter and shorter, but I hope maybe over the summer you all have the opportunity to work with some of those CCOs and see some of that overlap, because I think being in Astoria is really incredible, and I think that's some of the ways we're getting at it. I don't think we have the complete answer.
Thank you.
And the same goes for health inequities, too. If you're sending information on social determinants, it would be nice to have a little bit more information on the health inequities.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. It's an issue I'm incredibly passionate about, and I hope to see in the next set of metrics as well. The next steps on the action plan for health is the development of a dashboard report so that at the Health Policy Board and publicly we can put out a plan about where we're going and what's specifically happening on each of those action items. So health equity being one, you know, I think so the social determinants of health being another place, but sort of you know, what's happening across the work. And then I think the next piece is also alignment with the CCO 2.0, which I alluded to, that we're just kicking off a work plan around what does that look like. And the policy board adopted a process at our last meeting. And we're very excited to move forward on that work and the next form of CCOs and innovation. So with that, I'm happy to answer additional questions.
I just want to make sure that I so respect the work that's being done by the Health Policy Board, and I want to make sure that legislation that's proposed here, that legislators would take a look at the overall plan and make sure they're working together. Mm. All right. Thanks so much, Felisa.
Thank you.
With that, we will move on to the Oregon Health Integration Project. Dr. Shannon English, Jody Schwann, Doug Barber, and Amanda Cobb.
Amanda is being called in, so I'm going to call her right now.
Okay. We're calling Amanda right now.
Hi, Amanda. This is Cassie. We are in the Senate Healthcare Committee getting ready for your oral health integration project presentation.
So who wants to start?
I'll kick it off. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of Willamette Dental. As we've implemented healthcare reform in Oregon over the last few years, we've talked a lot about integrating oral health with behavioral and physical health. Last year, Willamette Dental and Trillium CCO undertook a pilot project to demonstrate how oral health integration can both improve overall health and save money. They targeted tobacco users and diabetics, and as you'll hear, the impact was dramatic. It's the best example I've heard of showing what oral health integration really means and why it's so important. And with me today is Dr. Shannon English, who was Willamette Dental's chief clinician on the project.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm the managing dentist of the Eugene and Valley River offices of Willamette Dental. And they're in Lane County, and we got this grant through Trillium. So we identified some of our patients that were at high risk for caries or periodontal disease, and caries being a chronic dental disease, which more in layman's terms is cavities. So we identified the high-risk patients with a tool within our electronic health record, and then we identified those within that group that were tobacco users or diabetic. And we took those patients and we gave them preventive products. So we gave them chlorhexidine, which is an antibacterial mouth rinse. We gave them ClinPro, which is a prescription strength fluoride toothpaste, about five times the amount as regular over-the-counter toothpaste. This also has tricalcium phosphate, so the calcium and phosphate are more available for the building blocks of the enamel. And we also gave them xylitol, which is a sugar substitute and also known to decrease caries. We had these patients in every 3 months to give them their refills and reassess and see how they were doing. Go ahead and flip one more. We could not do this without our care advocates. So we took our patient service representatives at the time and trained some of them to be care advocates. So they were they reached out to the patients. They would call in the patients. They would help educate the patients. They were kind of our connector. They did follow-up calls and even reached out to those that had not been into the office yet. They created a relationship with them to increase their engagement. Just one more person involved in their care. And it was someone also that they could look to as a peer. Because sometimes when patients come to the dentist, if they haven't been in a while, there's a lot of intimidation and a lot of shame. And they are there to help bridge that gap with their compassion. They also help to coordinate if they needed help, assistance in getting medical appointments. And we track their contact with the patients through our electronic health record. go ahead and click one. So evidence-based dentistry is basically using what we know works as prevention to help fight dental disease. And that's one of the missions at Willamette Dental. It's our mission to deliver proactive patient care through a partnership with our patients to stop the disease repair cycle by means of evidence-based methods of prevention and treatment. So basically, it was a natural fit for our office. We did targeted outreach to increase the engagement, and we kind of helped to integrate the medical and dental, which is something that has been missing, that we're really looking in Oregon as well as countrywide of improving in a lot of the dental groups within the state. We also wanted to find a way for the patients to have access to these patient products, because a lot of times it's not covered by their dental plan to have this. And we wanted to show that by utilizing these products, not only did they save on their dental care, but also saved on their medical care. And next one. So this kind of goes a little bit over the connection between periodontal disease and tobacco and diabetes. So tobacco is a known risk factor. It kind of increases the severity of periodontal disease because they have less oxygen to the tissues, and so there's less healing. And the same thing goes a little bit with diabetes as well, but unfortunately, diabetes and periodontal disease have a relationship where they both affect each other negatively. So someone has decreased healing, therefore the periodontal disease worsens, therefore increase of bacteria in the bloodstream and infection, which makes it harder to control their diabetes. So if we can find a way to help improve this by means of prevention, we can help their overall health. All right, the next one. All right, and one other thing I wanted to add in there, too, is with the xylitol. That's a known prevention tool that helps fight these diseases, but it's also a sugar substitute. It's natural. It's found in fruits, vegetables, and it decreases the amount of plaque that attaches to the tooth. And it also, the bacteria try to utilize this sugar, and they cannot. But it's also nice because if you're diabetic, it's nice to have something on hand when you want something. And the form of xylitol is usually gums, mints, candies, things that are very helpful. Another thing with diabetes and smoking, you get an increased dry mouth or xerostomia, and these are a good solution to that, as well as that dry mouth being a causative factor in the disease of caries. It's really nice to read about how the oral health integration, how this works, how people get healthier, but to really see it in action is very exciting. And so I'd like to turn this over to Jody. She was a care advocate in our Valley River office, which had the largest population of patients on this grant, and I'd like for her to share some of her experience.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Jody Schwan. Like she said, I work for Willamette Dental as a care advocate. Fortunately, part of this program. The care advocate part of this program is the relationship part of the business, not strictly, of course, but the cheerleader part, the connection between the other doctors, or the connection between that makes sure the doctors are connecting. People that hear they have extreme disease of any kind orally, oftentimes she spoke to the shame. That's true. The initial response is always emotional with them, so they don't hear a thing. Oftentimes they don't hear a thing that is told after that. So in order to take it to the next level, the care advocate is the teacher, would flesh out any questions that they have, and part of the clinical staff also. My favorite story is the one at the very top, and it is because that family stands out, and it really is the true ring of the whole entire program, actually. There is a family, a member of our community and our office, who has he has regular care for the first time in his life, but his whole entire family is receiving regular care for the first time. And it has to do with an attitude change. He became a regular patient, used the products regularly, saw that what we told him was the truth, and wants to change it generationally. His health is better. His kids bust in, indeed, like we are baking cookies there, not doing dental treatment. There's all sorts of other things going on there that aren't, where we're not baking cookies. But indeed, it's changed generations is what can happen here. Expanding the program out to all people would help be valuable, futuristic speaking, to change statistics with oral health and health in general. We spoke to the way that it affects health overall. People feel that with this program, there is an advocate, someone speaking for them, speaking to them, working with their doctors, ideas how to be a healthier diabetic. Things that cannot be changed, some can be improved. Futuristic generational changes. Young mothers who have never taken care of themselves go on to talk about how their lives are different at their houses. They brush their teeth together. They're learning the importance of the oral health and of the products themselves. I agree with Dr. English, and I think it's one of the biggest factors is the products were important because of the way that they started to feel health-wise. It was a direct relation to a result. The sugar snacks, those things help so much with diabetic. I live with a diabetic, and it's hard to find something for that quick fix when you're not going to be eating the cookie. That it just disruptive to your health in general. The products are very helpful. Mostly what I've seen, besides a change in overall attitude toward healthcare and toward dental care, is a change in people's attitudes toward the future and their health in general. Realizing that the oral health is also a work in progress, like everything else with their health and how it all fits together. The mentally ill patients may be the most success of all. People that admittedly come and discuss about the difficulty they have taking care of themselves in general. Having had relationships with their doctors, connecting with their care, moving forward. Anything else? Yeah. I think, and we have, I have many, many, I call them my own patients, okay? They're my patients. They're the patients I followed up with call. And with care and with their families. And I have more than a third of my patients are current with their dental care. And another third of them lost insurance altogether. So feel like it has been a very successful program in our office and in our community. Thank you.
And Amanda?
Are we moving
Are you there, Amanda?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. So,
state your name for the record.
Oh, sure. I'm Amanda Cobb. I'm the manager of data analytics and reporting at Trillium. And we worked with Willamette Dental to exchange information for our members with diabetes and or tobacco use. And then we did an analysis looking at costs year over year for these folks, and we compared them with other members of ours who had diabetes and or tobacco use and who did not have an intervention with Willamette Dental. And what we found was that for those members enrolled in this program, they saved on average over $700 in a year. And the members that weren't involved in the program, as you would expect, their costs went up over $500 on average for the year, resulting in savings of $1,200 on average for the year, or about $100 per member per month. In particular, the savings were realized by fewer hospital stays, primarily over 50% of cost savings were related to that, as well as reduced need for office visits. So while this isn't a return on investment analysis, it doesn't include the cost of the program, it does show in the data that this intervention that Willamette Dental Trillium partnered on has the potential to result in significant cost savings.
Senator Steiner Hayward has a question.
Well, a question and then a comment, if I may, Madam Chair. What does it cost to hire, give one of, I'm not trying to pry into your personal life, but how much are you paid? How much does it cost for your salary and benefits, and how many families or individuals can you have in your panel on an ongoing basis? You don't understand? I'm trying to do an informal cost-benefit analysis here, right? I mean, Amanda says net savings of $1,200 per year per diabetic patient. Now, obviously, it's going to be less in the short term, at least for children or whatever, but it will be real because children with caries, it's more expensive to take care of them than adults with caries, right? Because you often have to do anesthesia and all that nine stuff. But in the long term, it will also save us a lot of money if we get those kids' oral health in good shape before they become adults, right? So I guess what I'm trying to figure out, like, I'm being very inarticulate this morning. You know, a while ago, St. Charles Hospital hired some care coordinators for their frequent flyers in the emergency department, right? They were paying, their net cost per care coordinator was about $75,000 salary and benefits per year. And they saved $600,000 in the first 6 months of the program or something ridiculous like that by helping people get to their outpatient appointments and not going to the emergency department all the time. So how are we doing? What's the balance here? If we have somebody like you that we're paying to do this, which is a great thing to do, don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining about that. I'm just trying to understand the cost-benefit analysis here.
Well, yeah. Well, one thing, we did take our existing patient service representatives, and this has actually transformed this position to where they are all now care advocates.
So they're not new positions at all.
They're not new positions. So, but it's really helped us evolve how we want to be as providers, and
right.
Starting with every member of our team. So we really focused in on training our kind of, yeah, our schedulers to really be more of an outreach.
So in essence, it's the equivalent in a dental practice of a medical practice, patient centered primary care home, mm-hmm. where everyone's engaged in team-based care to
absolutely.
Engage all of the patients in a comprehensive way. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah. Yes.
Analogy?
The care advocate position has been an evolving position.
Thank you.
Yes.
And if I may, Madam Chair, thank you. Putting my budget hat on for a minute, $100 a member per month, that's a lot of money in my world. I mean, if you look at it across the entire spectrum, when we know how many people in CCOs have, under OHP, have poor oral health, and we know the implications of kids missing school time because of dental pain, which is really significant, and we know the incidence of emergency department visits for dental pain, which is a really significant issue, And Madam Chair, I've had the privilege of being on this committee for 6 years now, 5 years, a long time. How many times have you heard me say it's impossible to control someone's diabetes if they have poor oral health? And I think this is pretty clear evidence of that. And this is pretty short-term savings based on what Amanda's saying, right?
Yes.
So in the long term, those savings could only be expected to go up because you're avoiding more hospitalizations, coronary artery disease, et cetera, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what's it going to take us to expand this? And how are you guys helping other practices roll this out?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I think at this point we've just seen the results of that first-year program. And we're trying to work with our CCO partners to figure out how we can take the results of this and expand it to both the other CCOs and to expand it to other types of patients in all of the CCOs, because it's not just diabetics and tobacco users who could benefit from this.
No, I mean, the kids are really important here.
But we just got the results of this, so it's fascinating to see the...
So just in a year, you're seeing that $1,200 delta.
Yeah, correct.
That blows my mind. That just blows my mind.
Well, just the changes in that one family alone, five children. And many of my patients alone, that has been their focus. If they feel it's too late for them, they'll continue with what they're doing, continue with their care, and continue to try to improve that. But what they're really focused on is generational changing.
Okay, we need to wrap up, but Amanda, do you have anything more that you would like to add?
The only thing I would add is that, just for context, we've got over 4,500 members who have diabetes and or tobacco use. So the potential for this program to significantly impact is quite big.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Good work. All right, I'd like to, we're now going to talk about the Oregon Community Health Information Network, Jennifer Stoll and Paul Matthews.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Stoll, for the record. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for OCHIN, the Oregon Community Health Information Network. Thank you for having us, Madam Chair, and members of the Senate Healthcare Committee. We're thrilled to be able to be here today. With me is Paul Matthews. Paul is our Chief Technology Officer, OCHIN's Chief Technology Officer and Chief Security Officer. He's a nationally renowned treasurer, and he's going to talk about how data moves and how we are very good about security around the data, and so we're going to talk about that. Just starting off on who OCHIN is. Oops, how did I get that? Okay. OCHIN is a nonprofit, mission-focused company based in Portland. We were designed and built as originally as a true public-private partnership incubated out of Multnomah County and Care, Oregon. We're really with the goal to create economies of scale within technology, especially around medical records. Medical records are not inexpensive things, as you can imagine. So the goal was to be able to support the safety net providers in Oregon, being able to provide a low-cost alternative for technology. And while our roots are here in Oregon, we've now grown to one of the largest safety net technology providers in the nation. And we, by coming together to create... Okay, hold on. Okay. So this is kind of our history. Why do I keep clicking on the wrong button? Okay, so... by coming together, we have been able to create one single medical record. The OCHIN Collaborative creates a highly cost-effective alternative for safety net customers, some of which include public health entities like Multnomah County, the Oregon Youth Authority, and other FQHCs throughout Oregon.
So here's an example of how we work. And so our medical record, and Paul's going to speak to this, is able to exchange data with multiple different organizations. OCHIN is a very unique Oregon treasure. As mentioned, the collaborative has built one of the largest data repositories in the nation of safety net data. And with our partners, this repository is used by OCHIN researchers and our partners from OHSU, Kaiser Center for Health Research, and other partner institutions across the country to mine the data and to answer questions impacting the safety net and broad healthcare issues. We have over 10 million patients in our medical record database, and including clinical records of over 50% of the Oregon Medicaid patients. OCHIN has outstanding analytical capabilities. Basically, you name it, and we can help research it. We partner with the majority of the CCOs with their clinical metrics and to help them achieve their metric payments. And we're leading analytics and research around numerous other areas, including opioids in the safety net, alternative payment methodologies, and social determinants of health. And speaking of social determinants of health, we really are leaders in this area. We were talking about it before it was even cool to talk about social determinants. OCHIN has one of the most robust research and analytic portfolios in the nation in this area and is a nationally recognized leader. And we've received multiple grants funded by the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and Patient Center Outcomes Research Institute, PCORI, and others. Additionally, last year, OCHIN helped lead the National Research Conference on Health Equity in Portland with OHSU's Family Medicine and other partners. And we've implemented and developed cutting-edge social determinants of health tools in the EHR to enable data collection at the point of care integrated with population management tools. So this technology allows our clinic members, the means to connect patients to social resources in the community. So with this introduction to OCHIN, I want to hand it over to Paul to share a little bit more with you about OCHIN and how EMR works.
Hi, good morning, Chairman Mons Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Paul Matthews. I am the Chief Technology Officer for OCHIN. I also serve as the Chief Information Security Officer. So Jennifer was alluding to, one of the things that OCHIN has accomplished is the ability to move information for analytics purposes. And while establishing a medical record system allows us to provide straight care to the patient through our member organizations across the state and across the nation, the big part of the reason that OCHIN was actually created was to look at data for health policy and understand what it means to actually do analytics and research. One of the big areas that we concentrate on is actually on feedback into the clinic. How do we change the protocols and the workflows within the clinic to better serve the patient and actually improve those outcomes? Because collecting data is only one step of actually doing analytical work. When we look at the way that OCHIN functions and the movement of information, this is just a small snapshot taken in June of this year. So in June of this year, we'd actually, for the 12-month period, we'd moved 10 million patient records in and out of our platforms to other organizations outside of OCHIN's medical record system. And we include that with mental health organizations. We work very, very heavily with a group called NetSmart to move mental health information and look at the effects of policy around the exchange of mental health data, substance abuse disorder information, and move that to the clinical regime. The other piece that we do is also look at dental information. So we actually have a combined mental health, oral health, and clinical health repository of data, and not only from our own platforms that we host two medical record systems, but we bring data in from 10 other medical record products around the country of all different types of vendors and combine that into a single central repository. So I'm going to skip some of this, but it's the goal for us is to look at the exchange of information not just for clinical purposes, but also to understand the fact that a member may be seen at a hospital and that the admission information and the discharge information for those frequent flyers is very important to understand. And so we've recently been working very heavily with Collective Medical Technologies, who is the organization that's created EDI, the Emergency Department Information Exchange, to incorporate all of their medical data all of their admission and discharge data into our clinical data repository. So actually our member organizations can say that their patients not only were seen at an acute care facility, but also were seen at a specific acute care facility on a specific date, and do the outreach necessary to those patients to reduce their readmittance into the emergency room. So that care gap is actually being fulfilled now by other technologies that we incorporate. We also look at, there's a slide actually hidden in here, so I won't bother unhiding the slide. It was talking about the amount of information that we have. If we look at our, we have two hosted medical record systems, one today, which is the Epic system, used by a vast majority of the acute care organizations in the state, has about 1.9 million active patient lives. Those are active patients that have been seen within the platform in the last 12-month period. We also have a next-gen hosting system. That next-gen platform has about 1.8 million active lives in there using the same measure. And then we bring in the additional information from hospital systems. We do primary care association data mining. And the importance of that information is actually to look at things like, can I do comparative studies, provider against provider, on the healthcare outcomes of their patients, provider to clinic goals, clinics to organizational, organization to organizational metric analysis, and can I compare those against meaningful use requirements, HEDIS measures, healthcare 2020 outcomes? So the goal for us is to look at the mining of that information and then match that back into things like social determinant data. So we take all census information across the U.S., we bring that information into our research system, and we're able to show things like diabetic care for patients and how it may improving, and link that back to oral health care, link that back to food deserts, transport capability. So the whole goal of OCHIN is that mining of information. So I'm going to pause there and allow for the committee to ask any questions they wish.
So does each clinic hire you, or is this, how are you funded?
So we actually operate under a couple of things. We originally started under grant funding opportunities from the federal government and from the state of Oregon. From there, we have actually now the member organizations pay a fee for a per-visit basis, and they also pay for a fee, other organizations will pay a fee for the hosting on a per-patient basis for the analytics purposes of their data.
Is Medicaid data included?
Yeah, Medicaid data is the predominant amount of information. The piece that is missing for us is the claims-based information. We need access to the Medicaid claims information to round out what we're doing on the clinical side.
We all would love to have that information. The all claims, all payer database.
And we have, Senator Monsanto, we have actually incorporated in the past and actually done the work and pre-built out the capability to take all payroll claims. And we do have information coming in from some Medicaid payers already into the repository, but we don't have the complete picture for the state.
Other questions?
If I could just make a comment, Madam Chair. I think I've had the privilege of working with OCHIN one way or another for probably almost as long as it's been around, if not as long as it's been around. And the work that they do in an really unbiased, nonpartisan, patient-centered, public health-centered way is so important to advancing the work of the state and healthcare transformation. You know, Ms. Hagen's presentation on CCO 2.0, the work that the Senate Bill 440, you know, Combined Quality and Metric Scoring Committee work is doing. All of that depends on really good data analysis that looks not only at Medicaid data but at commercial payer data, and that's why ensuring that organizations like OCHIN that have such a strong track record in data analysis have access, easy access to the all payer, all claims database, not in ways that violate confidentiality, but as strong partners to the state, the de-identified data that can make such a huge difference in understanding things like what Willamette Dental just presented to us, whether we are actually saving money and improving health and improving the overall health of our communities and improving the patient experience of care. We can't do that unless we have organizations with a strong track record of analyzing this material, looking at a much broader spectrum of data than just what they have in their own system, and comparing it state to state. How are we doing compared to other states?
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for coming. We'll probably be hearing from you in the future.
Let's go to the multiple sclerosis drug pricing study. I'm hoping that Lee Beyer and Canope are going to come back shortly.
Beyer's testifying. I just saw him on TV.
Yeah.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Dennis Bordet. I am a board-certified neurologist and a multiple sclerosis expert. I'm also chair and professor of neurology at Oregon Health and Sciences University, but I'm here today as a private citizen and not representing any position of OHSU. I want to talk today about the rising costs of multiple sclerosis drugs. Just some quick facts. MS is a disabling disease that affects the brain, spinal cord, and optic nerves. It has an average age of onset of 30. It's not a fatal illness, so patients live with this disease for decades. And without treatment, it is usually a disabling illness. About 500,000 Americans are affected by MS, and we estimate about 7,000 Oregonians have it. Oh, I'm going to go back. I need to go back a slide, which maybe I can do here. Thank you. I just want to give you an overview of what I want to discuss in the next few minutes. The number of FDA-approved drugs for MS has risen from 3 in 1996 to 17 in this year. The annual median price of MS drugs have risen from $10,000 in 1996 to nearly $80,000 in 2017. A pattern, which I'll show, arose starting in 2002, in which each new drug came in at a higher price point than all the other drugs. And following that, all of the MS drugs, including the oldest, would raise their prices in response to the new price point.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
The change in pricing, is that because change in the drugs that are prescribed to newer drugs, or is that just change in just because they wanted to raise the price?
Well, as I'll show you, the old drugs that have been around for a long time hadn't changed at all and raised their prices to match those of the newer drugs. It's just because.
A little bit of price gouging.
I can give you a personal example on that one.
Senator Steiner-Hayward?
I was just going to say, I can give you a very personal example on that one. I think I've told this committee the drug that I used for my MS was, when I started on it in 2007, 10 years ago, was $7,000 a dose. It's now $16,000 a dose. Same drug, 10-plus years later, $16,000 a dose.
Thank
Close
you.
My mind.
Yeah.
Total cost of MS drugs was $9 billion in the U.S. in 2012. It's substantially higher now, but I don't have that figure for you today. So as I mentioned, the first MS drug was introduced in 1993. There's 17 of these drugs now. They work in they're nine different categories. They have a different mechanism of action, different route of administration, and different side effect profiles. The advantage of this to physicians and their patients is that we're able to customize, or should be able to customize, therapy and find a drug that works for all patients with MS. And then, as I've mentioned, the median wholesale acquisition cost of MS drugs now is $78,000, ranging between $63,000 and $87,000. We do not have access to the actual prices that insurance companies are paying for the drugs, since that's a negotiation that takes place between the companies and is kept as a trade secret. Colby. Now, this shows all the drugs that are available currently, starting with the first one, beta serum, that was released in 1993, and ending in 2017 with three drugs, Ocrevus and two generic drugs that came out this year. As you scan over that, you see the prices are quite high, and I'll show you in a moment, don't relate to when they were introduced. There is a trend that we should talk about at the end. That is, Ocrevus is a new drug that came on the market at $65,000 a year. And this was the first time a new drug had come on the market at a lower price, although that, as I'll explain, is there's probably reasons for that, partly having to do with advocacy and which has been brought to bear on these drugs in the last couple of years. So I want to spend a little time with this graph. It shows each of the drugs for MS with the date when they came on and their initial price. And then we show how the prices have changed over time. And so you will notice that the first three drugs shown in green, blue, and red, which are Betaseron, Avonex, and Copaxone, had a price of about $10,000 per year, and it remained with only very modest increases each year that way until the year 2002. In 2002, a new drug, Rebif, was introduced, and it was essentially the same as Betaseron and Avonex. It could be considered a me-too drug, but the company decided to bring it on the market at 50% higher than the current drugs at that time. That's shown, do I have here? And this set the pattern that we began to see with each successive drug. So the prices of the three drugs that had been stable rose to match that of their competitor. In 2004, Tysabri was introduced at a very high price. This was a new class of drug, but again, that continued to result in a rise in the four drugs that were on the market at the time. And this pattern of a continuing rise each year has pretty much continued until 2017. Mm-hmm. So we've gone from this situation with a median price of $10,000 to close to $80,000 per year, with all drugs rising, including the oldest drugs, without any thing new or a novel about those new drugs.
Senator Beyer.
So I think I've seen in your list there are a couple of generics. So is there, how many of them are off patent?
The only one that's currently off patent is Copaxone. That was one of the three founding drugs. Hmm. There'll be a second MS drug that will come off patent next year. I wanted to focus in on the behavior of the pricing for the three original drugs, Avonex, Betaseron, and Copaxone, because this is the clearest demonstration of this effect. So again, we see this relatively flat line in the prices during the first few years of the drug being on the market. And then in 2002, shown here, the third beta interferon, which is what these two drugs are, was introduced. Rebif at a 50% premium, and that started a rise in all three of the drugs. They again rose after the introduction of Tysabri, and you'll see actually the inflection point rises even more, so that the rate of change increased substantially then. And then when the first oral drug was introduced in 2010, we again continue to see a continual rise in these three drugs that have been around since the mid-1990s. For the first initial drugs, we've seen average annual increases in their prices ranging between 11% and 15%. In some years, they've raised their prices by 24 to 26 percent, this is a substantial increase in price given the base from which they're rising. So Senator Breyer raised a question about generics. Teva is the branded Copaxone. It has been on the market since 1996. It comes in two versions, 20 milligrams once a day and 40 milligrams three times a week. Last year, over a year ago, the first generic was introduced, and then this year, two versions of the glatiramer acetate, that's the trade, the generic name, was released. And this is currently the annual cost of those drugs. You'll see that the generics came in at still a relatively high price, $63,000 to $65,000. And the Copaxone's price, particularly for the one that they're pushing, the three times a week version, is a little bit higher. This pricing is modestly lower by a few thousand dollars than it was when the first generic was released. So there's been some modulation in the branded price.
Is there any reason why the larger dosage of Copaxone is cheaper than the smaller?
So before the patent ran out on their drug, they brought to market a three times a week, instead of a daily injection, a three times a week drug, which is the 40 milligrams. And they aggressively marketed this to patients, which included calling them up directly and telling them about this new version. They drove the price of the once a day up and came in with a lower price on the 40. And as a consequence, they were able to switch over 60% of their patients from the once a day to the three times a week. And they did that a year before the first generic came out. And they did it, in my opinion, solely to have a whole bunch of people on three times a week. And so that blended the effect of the once-a-day generic. We just recently have a three times a week generic for this version that just became available.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Steiner-Hayward.
If I could point out, this is a altogether too common tactic of the pharmaceutical manufacturers, the large pharmaceutical manufacturers. They'll take an existing drug and tweak the formulation one way or another that allows them to get a new patent and extend their patent. You'll notice that from the slide that Dr. Bordet had up earlier, Copaxone glatiramer acetate has been on the market less long than Avonex, for example, or which is not off patent yet. And it's because they've done a range of things to extend their patent, and it is altogether.
Well, you know, there are some class action lawsuits against the insulin manufacturer, and that's, you know, my sister's diabetic and my neighbor, and they let me know what's happening with the cost of insulin and truly believe it's price fixing. And I don't know enough about the competitive marketplace, but I know with the pharmaceuticals, it's certainly different than the other normal competitive market. Other things in the competitive market. So I don't know if you know why the pharmaceuticals act differently than anything else in the competitive marketplace.
Because they can.
Senator Anderson,
I agree.
Because
audience.
They're allowed to do it.
Well, and because, I mean, sorry, Madam Chair, but give me a choice about whether I'm going off my MS drug or not.
That's right.
I'm not. Mm. It's that simple. I have been rock solid stable, thank God, for almost 10 years now. Do you think I'm going to change my drug? I'm not. And I feel guilty when I go in and have to my insurance company spend that much money. I'd like to think I'm paying it back. But honestly, I can choose whether I buy a new television set or not. I really don't want to have to make a choice about whether I get my MS medication or not.
Well, that's why I'm so excited about the transparency prescription drug pricing bill that's probably going to come forward. And I think pharma's on board with that, too.
It's only for generics.
And it's only for generics. Yes, that's a problem. I'd rather have it for all of them. But do you think that transparency at the state level will help the state?
Senator Anderson, yes, I do. I should point out that I wanted to come back to the Ocrevus, the new medicine that came on at a surprisingly low price, if you will. We were anticipating it coming on the market at about $90,000. It came on at $65,000. I believe very strongly that they did that for PR reasons, because beginning in about 2015, prior to 2015, no neurologist and the National MS Society was not speaking out about the rising cost of MS drugs. In 2015, we published the first paper on the subject in a neurological journal. The MS Society then decided to begin taking a position on it, and they've been very vocal now about the rising cost. And the MS companies that make MS drugs have heard a lot from physicians, the National MS Society, and other patient groups. And I believe that Ocrevus was brought on market at a lower price, largely for PR purposes. And I think that that's an example of a change in behavior that was triggered by people shining a light on this problem and speaking out about it.
We need to wind this up. Do you have anything further?
No.
No. All right.
I think
any
I was just going to say thank you.
Yeah, this good really gives a reality check, because, you know, MS isn't the only drug that is just unbelievably overpriced. That's just my words. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's call Pat Allen up to give the Oregon Health Authority update.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of, of the Oregon Health Authority. I was actually going to come up here and start out with, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, but didn't think that would be appropriate either. I want to talk about four things today briefly. I want to talk about, give you a quick update on leadership and structural issues that we're working on in the agency. I want to talk about a progress report on the redeterminations of eligibility. Talk about the overpayment issue that's been in the media lately, and then briefly talk about the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. First, in terms of leadership, I don't have a whole lot to say that that we haven't already talked about in terms of some of the structural things that we've done around splitting up the chief financial officer, chief operating officer, looking at the structures that deliver our health insurance systems, including the Oregon Health Plan. I will say that I expect to get a set of structural recommendations later this month from our staff who are working on that. We then expect to spend some time engaging with our employees and other stakeholders on kind of ground truthing that recommended structural changes, so we've got the ability to fine-tune and incorporate that feedback. I would expect that in December we'll then make an announcement of what changes we'll make and make those effective in January. So the main idea is to make sure we're making changes that are thought out and vetted with our stakeholders, and that we do one set of changes one time, so we only put employees through that kind of through those structural changes once. The thing I want to spend a little bit more time talking about is some of what we've been turning up. The overpayment issue was one of them, but there have been some other things that have that we have become aware of very recently. Last week, I think on Thursday, an employee brought to me a sheaf of papers about an issue that has to do with a potential error when two different people who are similar to each other both enroll in the Oregon Health Plan, and a way that may be being misprocessed. A Department of Human Services shared services staff in accounting has given us a list of concerns they've got business processing in the Oregon Health Plan. There was the overpayment issue that we read about in the last couple of weeks. by themselves, each of these don't appear to be the kind of things that are individual budget busters, but collectively they raise a lot of concern about what I would call the business-like rigor of the management of the Oregon Health Plan. And so we're actively trying to identify as many of these problems as we can, reconcile them so we know exactly what we're looking at, and I'll come back to that on the overpayment issue, and then get at the root causes that are driving those problems. The analogy I've used a little bit is that OHA, in some senses, has operated a bit like a startup over the last since the time it was created. And like a startup, it's gotten some really incredible things accomplished, adding 400,000 people to the Oregon Health Plan despite the challenges with the Oracle system, driving down health care costs about $1.3 billion over that period of time from what they would have been otherwise. But like a startup, there are also operational and business issues that I think that need need some attention now. And I think we're kind of at that stage where maybe the shareholders bring in a CEO, and that's kind of, you know, analogous, I think, to where we are right now with the team that we're trying to put together to establish that business-like rigor around those management issues. Each of those things I just ticked off, we're just beginning to find out about, and so we'll have more to report about them as we thoroughly vet them and understand what's going on. You know, one of the interesting challenges is you've probably heard the phrase, don't bring me a problem without bringing me the solution. I actually hate that phrase. My job is to get the problems that don't have solutions. My job and my management team's job are to get the hard things that people don't know what to do with, because if they know what to do with them, they should just actually go fix them. And so what we're really trying to do right now is encourage that notion of bring us stuff you don't know what to do with, or that you know, think is a problem that's not been addressed, or that there's a challenge, because we actually need to know that stuff, and it's our job to help wrestle those to the ground and try to figure out how to address them. I've done some communications kinds of things to try to facilitate that. Another phrase you hear a lot is, I have an open door policy. I have an open door policy, but if you call my assistant and ask for an appointment, if you're, you know, one of our staff, you'd probably get a date that's a month and a half from now, which is not functionally an open door. So what I've done is institute office hours, kind of like when you were in college and the professor would have known hours that were available. And so in Salem and at the Portland State Office Building, hopefully weekly, and then at our other offices less frequently, I'm there with announced office hours for an hour and a half or 2 hours, where people can drop by for whatever reason they want to be able to drop by for, to, you know, share something cool they're working on, or identify some kind of an issue. And this one of these that I mentioned came from that, from office hours. And so we're trying to cultivate that notion of bring us the gnarly problems, because we need to know about them and get them out on the table. Let me talk quickly about redeterminations. We'll have a more detailed report next month, but of course, the redetermination project of the working through the redeterminations of the 115,000 individuals who we were late with that work on has been completed. As of the last time we reported to you, which would have been figures as of August 31st, we had about 55,000 individuals whose cases were closed, a portion because they were found to no longer be eligible, and a portion because they didn't respond to our requests to determine whether they were eligible. As expected, that number has dropped through the retroactive period, where people can come back and say, hey, wait a minute, it turns out I am eligible. And so that 55,000 represents about 48% of the overall pool. The number that have been determined to be ineligible and have not still responded has now dropped 7 percentage points, or about 15%. So we've added back about 8,000 people who were eligible, in fact, out of that 55,000 number. And as I say,
how many did you say?
About 8,000.
8,000.
Yeah. We'll end up doing a full accounting during January ledge days. The numbers will be final as of sometime in December.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Steiner.
Mr. Allen, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have a question. Obviously, the issue around potential overpayments due to people with dual eligibility and things like that is dismaying.
Uh-huh.
And I think my sense is that you're working very hard to get to the root of that. I think many of us were dismayed to hear this was a problem that had been known long ago and not addressed.
I'm starting to get a feeling that, to use a very simplistic analogy, you're being faced with the cleaning out the closet problem, which is to say that when you have a closet that's jam-packed full of stuff that you need to tidy up, it often looks worse before it looks better, which is to say you have to take everything out and put it all over the living room floor, and then it looks like your house is a disaster area, and then you get rid of a bunch of stuff, you clean things up, and you put things back in a tidy fashion. I realize that's a simplistic analogy, but do you think it's fair to say that we may see other challenges before we feel like our closet is back in order at OHA?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Stenner Hayward, without doubt. I think we're coming to the end of what I would call the startup phase for OHA, and we're into the let's bring in a CEO phase, and so yeah, there are things that we're going to find out about. It's why this cultural notion of encouraging people to feel that they can come and talk and identify issues is just really critically important, because that's the only way to be able to find out what's in the back of the closet, if you will.
Thank you.
Let me talk about one box of shoes.
Senator Beyer. Oh.
The overpayment, I guess I'll say it that way. My assumption is there's very little likelihood that money can be recollected. Is that...
Oh, no,
Chair Mona Sanderson, true. Senator Barr, no, let me talk about that. Was actually the next thing I was going to talk about was the overpayment situation. The simple answer to your question is no. I think if in fact we're able to, when we finish reconciling those overpayments, to the extent that there are amounts that were in fact overpaid to CCOs, unless we determine that there was some documented decision based in law with some kind of an agreement or something like that we should be able to recover those dollar amounts. But the problem is more complicated than meets the eye, and at the risk of driving you all mad with detail, I want to illustrate that for you a little bit in this case. First of all, we've heard the number $74 million. And that $10 million has been recovered. And those are both numbers that were from OHA documents that were released as part of a public records request that the media reported accurately, and those were, in fact, what those documents said. Both those numbers are almost certainly wrong as we go to reconcile them, and they're wrong for a number of reasons. They're wrong in total, but they're also not the number that necessarily relates to CCO overpayments. Let me explain. Whatever the total number ultimately is, there are two things that feed that number. One is this notion of a capitation rate that is potentially too high for a dual eligible, someone who's on Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare pays first, and so the CCO should get less money per member per month for those dual eligible members. And so there's a dollar amount, and that's fairly straightforward. However, there's also buried in that same problem an issue of what match rate did we claim from the federal government. Did we treat them all as ACA expansion population at 100%, or were they, in fact, a mix of different eligibilities that have different match rates, which, in fact, is the case. And so there's a piece of that also is simply on OHA for the exposure related to the match rate. To make it even a little bit more complicated, people got health care in some significant number of cases from their CCO and not from Medicare. Well, that means Medicare actually owes us money. And so you actually have to go in and figure out how to reconcile all of those things before you can get to a real answer of what is the problem, how much is it, how much is in which pocket, and how do you go about reconciling that and reclaiming money from CCOs to the extent that's a portion of the total. In each of these, in each of these problems, they tend to be at least as complicated as that. And so when it looks like we're sitting around saying, yeah, we've got a problem and we'll get back to you, that's kind of the nature of the excavation work we're trying to do to get to where we for sure understand what we're talking about, what the dollar amounts are involved, and what the right thing to do is.
So when a CCO bills, or however that system works, and they see that it's a dual eligible, couldn't they pick up the fact that, oh, we bill Medicare first and then Medicaid? How does that work?
I want to answer that in a way that doesn't sound like I'm saying $74 million isn't a lot of money, because $74 million is a lot of money. But it's not an amount, and when you break it out among 16 CCOs and put it in the context of the amount they get monthly on Medicaid, that it would necessarily be obviously noticeable. You know, a rough analogy would be you expected your electric bill for October to be $150, and it came in at $150.74. You wouldn't look at that and automatically say, "Ooh, I need to look into that. Something is obviously wrong." In terms of data matching, I think data matching throughout the system is one of the business rigor issues that we need to get a better understanding of and improve. It is potentially the underlying root cause of one of those other problems that I mentioned, and we need to look a lot more carefully at that, whether it's on the CCO side or on our side.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Sandra Steiner here.
If I may, I will freely admit that prior to the end of 2016, when I became chair, the Senate chair of the Human Services Sub, I thought I had a reasonably good understanding of Medicaid. Not so much. And I learned a heck of a lot in the past 11 months since I took over that role. And I would tell this committee and anybody listening that there are bare minimum about 10 categories in Medicaid, and they all have different match rates, and they all have different eligibility. And the numbers that the CCO, the payments that the CCOs get are lump payments. They're not necessarily broken out by categories. And as Mr. Allen said, I wouldn't want to claim that $74 million is nothing, but when you're looking at a $19 billion budget, for better or for worse, $74 million is not that much money in comparison to $19 billion. So it's hard to pick up spread across 16 CCOs and literally a million patients, not all of whom are dual eligibles by any means, but there may be other miscalculations that we're just not aware of because of these different match rates and different eligibility criteria. And this is one of the things that I admire about what Mr. Allen's doing, is the level of rigor and accountability that he's expecting. It's going to take a while to fix this, and we need to be cognizant of the amount of work it's going to take and patient with some uncertainty. Uncertainty is difficult, but it's absolutely guaranteed in this work right now. That $74 million is a rough guesstimate, I would argue, at this point. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Allen?
Yeah, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Hayward, it's probably a little bit better than a rough guesstimate, but we are narrowing down on a better number. That does raise one other point, though, that I did want to make, which is, as I did today, one of the lessons we've taken from the last couple of weeks is I'm going to start bringing the governor's office and you information about problems that we potentially identify much, much sooner than I would ordinarily be comfortable with. I'm going to bring them to you when they're sort of faint expressions of a, hey, you better look at this, because I don't want to get caught out making it look like we're trying to bury something when what we're really trying to do is scope it and identify it and quantify it and identify root causes. That really is where we were with the overpayment issue and wanting to really pin things down before we started talking publicly. I'm going to err now on the side of talking publicly much sooner with the hopeful understanding from you all that we will bring you more details as we get them, and that may cause things to change. We may come back and say, hey, you know, that thing that I told you about last month, turns out there's not a problem there. But we want to communicate sooner and more regularly to the extent we can.
And I appreciate that, because sometimes things come forward and we're reading it in the media before we even hear.
Me too.
And you do. So, Senator Beyer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It's an interesting problem you have. I was just sitting here thinking about that. If you go to CMS on one side, they say, oops, we paid you too much out of this drawer, give it back. And the end result is, oh, yeah, but you owe us more out of this other drawer.
Mm-hmm.
So it may, who knows? It may net positive, probably not. But
right. If I may, let me touch on the one other issue to provide you an update on, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. We've been waiting on Congress to reauthorize the funding for CHIP for a while. The latest intel we have. Consistently, what we've been told is there's not a problem. They're going to reauthorize CHIP. It's just a matter of when they do it. Right now, it appears to be in queue behind tax reform. And so the best intelligence is, the best information is December sometime. The challenge for us is we're one of the first states that actually run out of CHIP money. And this is after, there's a process in CHIP where you spend your own money and then money that's unspent from other states gets gathered up and redistributed out to states, and all that money will be done in December. We'll have enough cash on hand to pay a portion of the capitation payments for the month of December. A route to go would be to begin 1st of December sending out notifications to parents that their children's health insurance will end on January 1st. The governor's made clear to me that we're not going to do that, that we're not going to put families through that because Congress hasn't gotten its act together yet. She's asked for us to identify some options, which I think we've got, to be able to manage our cash in such a way that that we ought to be able to maintain coverage for kids through a reasonable period of time that will allow either Congress to act, presumably, or determine that they, in fact, aren't going to, and allow you in February to wrestle with that problem. So we do not anticipate sending out cancellation notices or anything like that, which would be due in the next couple of weeks if we were to head down that path. One other point I should make quickly before Senator Barr gets his question. There is a piece of this that you should know about, which is there was a population, about 40,000 kids on CHIP, who were on Medicaid before they moved on to CHIP at the higher CHIP match rate. There's a maintenance of effort requirement so that even if CHIP goes away, we have to move those kids back to Medicaid. And so there's a cost to us if there is no CHIP funding of about $2.3 million per month to cover those kids. And so there's no alternative available that doesn't result in some kind of a state financial exposure if we're in a world where CHIP doesn't get reauthorized. Again, everyone says CHIP's going to be reauthorized, so I think that's more hypothetical than real. Mm.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that really gets to my question. You have, given the instructions from the governor, you have enough financial flexibility to get to February?
We're examining that now, but I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
It's good. A conversation that we're having regularly.
Yeah.
It's problematic. I mean, if they don't act before they go on December recess, it'd be hard for them to come back and act unless they do it retroactively before March.
Well, our expectation is whatever they do, they will do retroactive to September 30th. Yeah. So again, I think...
It's just a cash flow issue?
It's just a cash flow issue unless something... unusual happens in Washington, which isn't as unusual.
That never happens.
With that, that's all I had for my update. I'd be happy to answer questions that you might
have. Are there questions or comments? Thank you so much, and we'll expect you to be back in January informational days to
Great.
Give us another update. All right.
I can just put on record, Madam Chair, that I'm delighted that Mr. Allen's been willing to do this just and is taking on the permanent
Yes.
position. Make sure yes. confirmation is momentarily.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Byer.
Just a comment, Pat. I really appreciate your frankness. It's been your trademark through all whatever job you've had, and it's really appreciated and a breath of fresh air getting that out of OHA.
Thank you.
Kidding.
Great. All right. With that, we are going to go over the discussion of some bills that might show up in 2018.
Yeah.
And so let's have Jeremy Jeff come forward and talk about the possible opioid bill that the governor's task force has been working on.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Rhodes. I'm a governor's senior policy advisor. One of my main jobs is to chair the governor's task force on the opioid epidemic. I'm also principally responsible for OLCC, the Oregon Lottery, and the Racing Commission for the governor's office. So I'm here to talk to you very briefly about the work that the governor's task force is doing on the opioid epidemic. We've had three meetings thus far, and we'll have our fourth meeting tomorrow. Senator Steiner Hayward serves on the task force. Thank you for your participation, Senator, as well as Representative Williamson and Representative Brock Smith. We've also had some significant engagement from other members of the legislature, Representative Malmstrom among them, and welcome additional participation, of course. I should say that all of our meetings are open to the public, and we have a website where we post all of our meeting minutes and our agendas. We want to be as transparent as possible and seek input from a wide variety of stakeholders from across the spectrum. So who's on the task force? Just really quickly, we have CCOs, the Oregon Medical Association, treatment professionals, judges, pharmacists, public health experts, law enforcement, and others. As you can see, it's a pretty wide variety of experts in the topic area, and it's really because this opioid epidemic touches upon all facets of our lives that we have to seek input from so many different people that have been working in this arena, and it's been invaluable to have that input. So what do we do and what do we have planned? As the chair alluded to, we are now working up some legislation for the 2018 session. In fact, that was the first thing that we got into as we convened our task force, because we just didn't have a lot of time to meet our deadlines to have something for 2018. So we're looking at pragmatically what is achievable during the short session and what we can do to move the ball forward and really set us up for even bigger, more sweeping changes in 2019 that we'll be taking a look at. This task force will continue past the 2018 session. It's not our intention to just get in there, get something done, and get out very quickly. So for that 2018 legislation, our last meeting, we had a very robust whiteboarding session where we came up with our, well, really put all of our ideas that we had discussed through the various meetings up on the board, and then ended up starring those ideas that we want to bring forward for the legislative body in 2018. Principal among those are updates to the prescription drug monitoring program. We've been examining everything from whether or not to make registration mandatory to make data entry for all narcotic pain medication prescription mandatory for data entry as well. We're looking also very carefully at insurance barriers to accessing MAT or medicated assisted treatment. This is something that has proven to be one of the most effective tools in the tool belt in combating the opioid epidemic, and we've heard from many individuals that there is a lack of access to appropriate medication when paired with treatment, for example, buprenorphine. So making certain that those are covered effectively, and looking also at what we call fail-first policies. So just by way of example, this is an instance where somebody will be prescribed the lowest cost option for opioids treatment rather than the most effective option first. And what treatment professionals say is they basically have to fail their way into the appropriate treatment option, and that's obviously not something that we can countenance when we're in the midst of an opioid epidemic. So we'll be taking a hard look, asking the insurance commissioner to take a hard look at what barriers there are and what we can do to remove those barriers. Finally,
are they at the table, DCBF?
Not officially, Chair Montes-Anderson. However, we are interfacing with them. And that'll kind of bring me to my last point, which is within the executive branch, what we're doing to make certain what we can do within our own shop to improve upon our practices. Lastly, something we call naloxone 2.0. The committee will be very familiar with naloxone, which is a drug that is used for overdose prevention. It really is a miracle in a lot of ways. It wakes people right up. It works very effectively. But that's, of course, just the beginning of the story. The problem is that we don't pair that with an immediate offer of treatment or help. And oftentimes, that just perpetuates the cycle. And so there have been some other states, principally Rhode Island, that have taken a look at this process and said if we pair the offer of treatment at close in time to the acute overdose episode, that's when we'll see the best results. And so we want to take a look at whether or not we can have that practice here in Oregon as well through potentially a pilot program to start. So those are the three things we're looking at for 2018. I should say there are some other things. Those aren't set in stone yet, but that's sort of what we're honing in on. And then Chair Mona Sanderson, as I alluded to, we are also looking within the executive branch to see what we can do to improve upon our own practices and make advancements through the executive branch action. So talking with our agencies that touch upon this opioid epidemic and seeing what practices they can institute to better serve Oregonians. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Senator Beyer.
Just curiosity question. If the example you use in Rhode Island, if the evidence is clear there, if they've run it, why would you run another pilot rather than just implement it?
Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Beyer, I think it's a question of funding principally. So what's this going to cost and where is the funding going to come from? And then just making certain that we have a program that fits for Oregonians, something that works in Rhode Island. While in a vacuum, the idea certainly makes sense. I think we want to make certain that it's a program that would work here in Oregon as well, particularly where we have a much starker urban-rural divide than we have, let's say, in a small state like Rhode Island that's in the Northeast. Well, thank you for the question.
All right. Thanks, Jeff, so much. For
my pleasure.
And maybe an update in January.
Absolutely, yes.
What has actually been submitted. That would be great.
Sure.
All right, another bill that I would like to just bring to your attention. We're still working on it. It's the concussion bill, expanding the list of healthcare professionals who can provide medical release to youth athletes. We've been working since, I think our first meeting was in July or August, meeting several times, and hopefully we're going to have a product. Well, we will have a product. There's still a lot of opposition from certain stakeholders, but hopefully we will. We are working to accommodate many of the problems that they see with that. Another bill is that was vetoed by the governor is the prescribing, the psychologist prescribing bill. We'll be bringing that back. We are working with the stakeholders, are actually working with the opposition that the stakeholders had last time and making the bill even better than it was before. So we're working on that. There may be, well, that's all that I know for sure at this point in time. There are a couple of other issues that are in the works, but so far I haven't seen a final product. Do anyone else have health care related bills?
I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a short session. I know the House is has several. We'll see what we get or what Elizabeth gets down in Ways and Means. With that, I have nothing further on the agenda. Cassie, did we cover it all?
We did.
All right. Does anyone else have anything? All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming. We're adjourned. Thank you, everyone, for coming. We're adjourned.